It's Wednesday, January 20th, 2010, and you're listening to episode 178 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 2 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
I'm not the belligerent one. My name's Chad.
This is Wayne.
My name is Pat.
Hey, this is Chris.
So Dan, why are you feeling so belligerent today?
Well, let me start off with something completely unrelated to my belligerence. I have a confession to make, and I wish Johnny G was here because he would
you
back...
always wish he was here.
I know.
We're not good enough for
he
you.
He would
That's right.
back.
I even come back and you don't even care.
Mm-hmm. I don't. I really don't. But Johnny G would back me up
so
in this confession. But he is not here to defend me, so I'm going to have to defend myself. But John, you're with me in spirit. So Carla goes out and buys me something which has changed my life. It is probably the best thing I have added to my personal repertoire since a major video game console, or maybe Mass Effect 2. I don't know. I'll find out in about a week, which is a Snuggie.
Oh, God.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Are you kidding?
That's a robe you wear backwards.
That was what we called wedgies. We're Snuggies.
Chris.
And so every time I hear Snuggie, I think about somebody getting their underwear yanked up to their ears.
Chris, it's not 1825 anymore. All right. Let me just
Back
start
then,
with
we
that.
Just called them blankets.
I'm
you wore an
unwearable blanket.
And they had holes in them anyway, so it was just like
it's a robe.
No, you know what this is. You know what this is.
As was the fashion then.
We only had one game, and it was called Stare at the Sun.
My 3-year-old wears a Snuggie. It's called his freaking footy pajamas.
All right. First of all,
he's harkening back to his youth. He's regressing again.
Let me start by telling you why you can each go to hell.
Okay.
I don't need to know why.
It is a backwards robe. It is just a piece of cloth. They look ridiculous. But you know what? They do exactly what they're advertised to do. They keep you warm. They keep you comfortable. John has one.
They also keep your masculinity completely in check, apparently.
Chris, as the only hermaphrodite on the show, you have nothing to add to this conversation.
As the only hermaphrodite on the show, I have a true perspective as to exactly what Snuggies can do to you. Saving by the twig and berries.
Oh, but he's tucking again.
John came up and he was crashing here for a night and he busted out a Snuggie. And I'm like, really?
He's tucking again? Is that what you
wow.
said?
Wow. You know, I think I may have to cut
it
this off because you're impugning John's
I don't think John will like you sharing this story.
Yeah, he's
right.
Got a rap.
Well, I want to hear it. I want to hear it. I just missed giving Dan a hard time. I want to hear it. Pat, shut your face. Go ahead, Dan.
No, hold on a second here.
You didn't have to hang up on me.
So then he says, "It's not a bear."
So
I don't get
all right,
it.
I don't either.
I just tried dialing John for those of you that aren't here, obviously, when we record. I just tried dialing John to get him to help me defend this. He didn't pick up his phone. So, but here's the thing. So John comes up here, crashes for the night, and he brings the Snuggie along with him. And Carl and I are both like, you know, really a Snuggie? Come on, man, what the hell? But he defends his Snuggie. So Carl and I have this thermostat war where it's the reverse of most relationships where she likes it cold and I like it warmer. And so she goes out and buys me a Snuggie. And I have to say, you know what? I used my Snuggie and damn it, I am proud of it. It does exactly what it's supposed to and it does it well. I feel warm and
you know,
I don't care who knows.
I have thermostat wars because I pay for the heat.
Here's the difference. I care about my wife.
And look where it got you. You're wearing a Snuggie and you're tucking in.
All right, Fear the Con 3. The website is up, fearthecon.com. If you've not signed up, definitely sign up. We will not belabor that too much at this point. We'll belabor that and bore you in latter episodes. Coming up in 2 episodes, this is 178.
Pat, are you laughing about the tucking in kind?
No, I'm just thinking about something.
Pat.
Yes, Dan.
You know, I heard a rumor there's somebody in our audience that likes you. I don't think it's true.
I don't either.
All right.
It's a bald-faced lie, you. Anyway, what are we talking about?
We're talking about how Dan wears robes wrong.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
This is episode 178. In 2 episodes, we are going to do a special on gamer health. And we are going to talk about 2 things. The bigger thing is little things that you can do to improve your health, whether through exercise, diet, whatever. And also, I'm going to bring a little bit of stuff on how gaming itself may be already improving your health, believe it or not. But here's the punchline.
I see what we eat during gaming. I do not believe it.
All right. Yeah, well, I'm going to try and I will try and bring something to show you where you are wrong again, but with this particular topic. Now, if you have a situation that you are in where you're struggling to figure out how to lose a couple pounds, lose a lot of pounds, how to just improve some aspect of your health, Chris has now completed his personal trainer training.
Hooray.
So I want to make clear up front, none of us are licensed medical doctors or anything like that.
Though I have played 2 in role-playing games.
But if you have any questions about health fads, about a situation you are in, get in touch with Chris, whether via email, chris@feartheboot.com, or the forums, or even posting to our blog, and post your questions to him soon. And he will try to do the research he needs to do and get an answer for you. And in episode 180, we are going to come back and talk about the issue of health, weight, all those kinds of things, which unfortunately are, all stereotypes aside, really a problem with our community. So be thinking about that in preparation for episode.
We have 3 fat hosts and 2 skinny hosts.
God bless
3
me.
3 skinny hosts.
You mentioned it being a health problem within the community. That's actually true, and it's of course been that way for a number of years. And I remember Dragon Magazine this must have been late 80s, I think. They had some stuff going on with the American Heart Association because they were recognizing that fact and recognizing, you know, the general poor health of a lot of gamers and trying to combat that.
So all of our stupid jokes aside, if you have anything you're struggling with or anything you want to talk about or you want us to talk about, do send that in and we will do our best to seriously research and discuss these issues coming back in episode 180. So something to be thinking about. Chad, someone sent in a question for you. I actually sent it to you, but I'm going to go ahead.
I did post that.
I'm going to go ahead and repeat it anyway because I'm curious about this as well. Now, there are, generally speaking, 2 archetypes of GM represented on this show, which are those that use notes versus those at improv, which is pretty much everyone and you. but he asked a question.
I'm still right.
He asked a question that ties in really well to the stuff that we're going to be talking about today, which is keeping notes within a game. Mm-hmm. And he asked, as an improv game master, how do you, Chad, keep your stories, NPCs, the incidental things that you make up or the players do as the game goes on? How do you keep that straight as a man where pen and paper never enter your hand in the course of a game, except maybe to pass somebody a note? Or do you keep it straight? Is it just a permanent improv basis?
The big problem that I have is
incontinence. What's the second problem?
Prolapse. Second problem I have is like names and dates. Proper nouns. You know, there's a recurring character. They encounter him every week. Yeah, sure, I remember the names of that character. But it's that character that they encountered 5 games ago. And it's, what's his name? And usually my players can kind of see that I'm dodging using the... I use dodges, basically. And it's like, oh, you go up to the bartender, and he's really happy to see you. And he likes you guys a lot. And they're like, no, he hated us. I'm like, yeah, that's right. He hates you guys.
But he seems in a strangely good mood today.
Hey, yeah. You know, you use
he seems
like,
to have forgotten the past transgressions.
Indeed. I kind of play with it like this. Normally, that kind of gets me by. But my players know me, and they're like, oh, his name is so-and-so.
Have you ever had a note guy come to your game that's taking notes on everything you say and knows more about what you said than you?
Yeah. They're a great resource. I'm like, here, let me see those. Okay, yeah, it's so-and-so. But on the other hand, I do... occasionally, if the game gets going real long and there's a lot of different like balls in the air, I take notes right then and there. I mean, I don't take like big campaign notes, but it'll be like bartender, name Jed, in city this, hates party.
Do you actually keep those from game to game?
I mean, no, I usually
don't. I don't think so. All right, let me ask the hard question here that may be going through the minds of some of our listeners.
Boxers or briefs?
Both.
Depends.
I wear boxer briefs, actually.
Isn't that just laziness? I mean...
boxer briefs? Laziness? No, it has support, yet the... Wait.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go on.
I Boxer briefs are either the best of both worlds
they
or the
are.
Worst of both
they
worlds.
They are the best
it depends
of both
on how
worlds.
You, yeah.
To me, they're the best.
I can't do boxers. Like, I might as well just be going commando. But no, I mean, isn't the complete non-note-taking, even when there's things you know you can't improv, you've said it, you as a game master have declared, this is a truth. This is this guy's name. This is his attitude. This is whatever. This is something that now has been declared and has to remain consistent. The fact that you don't take any notes... Is that just laziness?
No. Here's the thing. The guy's name's not important. It's the stories and the characters that are important. I have...
But isn't his attitude towards the party, the things you said about his background, his relationship with his wife? I mean, isn't that part of
it
the
is.
Character?
And doesn't it hurt immersion if you come back to it and you don't
know? Yeah, if the details don't matter.
No, see...
That's my question, is that you lose that level of immersion if they're looking for a name or if they're looking for something like that and, you know, you're just not fast enough on the uptake to come up with something or you pause enough to make them... to put that seed of doubt in their head that they're in the wrong place?
Yeah, Craig's right. I'd get completely out of character. Right.
Or Chris, even, for that matter.
Who?
What was your name again?
Huh? I know. Some guy.
Anyway,
it's like Crash.
Anyway, Corey's completely right here. I would be completely lost if you're going on, and you suddenly skip a beat.
Here's the thing. You guys shifted gears on me.
Right.
You started off with name. And I'm like, a name isn't important. Right. It isn't as important as
well,
character.
Name was an example. Name was
an example. But then you guys launched off of that from name to background, history, relationships to the characters. And I'm like, oh, well, no, that is important.
The point is, any detail you made up on the spot that might get recalled later, which without notes, no human being, unless they have a perfect eidetic memory, is going to keep straight.
I do remember.
Oh, but no, is that the answer? You do remember. Okay, that's my question. You do remember.
But
okay.
Is there something that helps you remember?
Are there mnemonics you use? Or?
No. It's the process.
Okay. Explain.
What I trip up on are the names, dates, places. It's like learning history.
Right.
I can learn history. I know the historical events, and I know how they relate, how they affect our modern life, and what caused them and the sociological changes, because I love history, right?
Right. Okay.
Versus Clark here, who was, there when it happened.
Clark, yeah. But the problem is that I have a hard time remembering what every history student has trouble remembering, names, dates, places. And the same thing is true with this. Throughout the week, I mean, people kind of have this idea that, oh, he doesn't take notes. So that means throughout the course of the week before the game, he isn't doing crap. He's just sitting on his thing, playing video games, doing his job, whatever. No, through the whole course of the week, I am mentally going through the game as much as any note taker would.
Okay.
I'm putting a lot of thought and brain effort into this. And like I said, my games, and this was back on the DM show, my games are collections of events that create a greater whole. I have things that I want to happen. I want the characters to go through this event, like a historical event. This thing happens. I don't remember the name, the date, or the place, but this thing happens. I know its relationships. I know its interconnectedness with history, with past events, how it affects the future, blah, blah, blah. Same thing with a story. I want this event to happen. I know how it connects to the players. I know how it affects the overall plot. I know where it's happening. Well, maybe not where it's happening. But I know all of the big picture stuff.
So it's almost more existential in nature.
Yeah.
Actually, what's interesting is hearing you say that you talk about the comparisons to history. Mm-hmm. If you go way back to ancient historians to modern historians, one of the things that changed over the past millennia is that what ancient historians used to focus on was concepts and categories versus specifics and chronology. That a modern historian is interested about putting the right person, the right place, the right time, being as objective as possible, whereas an ancient historian was more interested in saying, okay, if this guy was compassionate, we're going to give a narrative that describes his compassion and maybe leaves out other information because that was never their intention to begin with. And it almost sounds like that's your GMing style, that you are GMing towards a concept or towards what today we might call sort of an existential situation versus all the details that probably we in our modern I don't say fact oriented, but detail oriented, nitpicky minds might be worried
about. More empirical.
Yeah, the fact that the bartender was Ted last game and he's Bill this game.
Totally irrelevant.
Irrelevant to you because to you, you're more interested in the broader story.
Yeah.
And I was curious to hear your answer to that, partially because it's foreign to me as a note heavy GM, but also because we get people that write in and most people. I mean, not that we've done a survey, but at least anecdotally, most people we hear from use at least some degree of notes. Yeah. But we do get people who write in who say, I completely relate to Chad because I myself am the same way, that I'm a very improv, noteless GM. And they, like you, want to be clear that that doesn't mean they're lazy or make no preparations or whatever. Yeah. And so I wanted to give you a chance to really field this question.
And I especially want to answer the lazy part, too, is that just because you don't produce any work that you can physically hand somebody doesn't mean you're not doing work. I think about the game from week to week. I think about the campaign. There, I have goals. I have things that I want to do. I try to interrelate the characters. And I also do a lot of work with the players. If I'm doing a good job, because sometimes I drop the ball, but if I'm doing a good job, I really want to interact with the players over the course of the week, usually through email or like Wayne I see every day, and I can talk to them and I can draw out their characters. And if I have a greater understanding of their characters, that's what I need to plug it back into this story that I'm trying to create with them. And this is where it really gets into the hippie thing. And people are like, oh, story stick, is that it's not my story. It's our story. And I'm just kind of the guy manning the wheel. The captain of the ship is not the ship.
So what part of your advice, and I realize I'm putting words in your mouth, which is why I'm asking this in the form of a question as opposed to a statement, is what part of your advice be to people like you is just set the expectation for your group up front. The details are not important. Not to say, and I don't want to paint that too broadly, because I realize that that could
people
be...
People will nitpick that, like you guys did.
Well, that could be expanded outward into all kinds
like
of
absurdities. Like if Casey here joined the episode, and every time they would call him, like, Carl or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would get confusing.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
So, Dan, this actually is a question I have. I have a struggle, anytime I'm about to run a game, on what I need to bring in note-wise. And I've got the two extremes in the group here. We've got Chad who comes in with no notes. It's all up in his head. Mm-hmm. Versus you come in with a laptop a lot more like me. But I am curious, what do you come in with note-wise? Do you have like entire scenes descriptions written out? What actually is in the notes that you bring?
Well, I can tell you what's in the notes that I bring. But I think really the point I'd like to emphasize is what people ought to bring in terms of notes. So let me start with what it is I bring.
Yeah, because that's what I'm particularly curious about, because I've seen the games that come out of what you bring.
Okay, coming into a game, now first of all, we run a lot of homebrew, so a lot of times when I've got the laptop open...
No, we run Battletech.
Nothing but Battletech.
Nothing but.
Yeah, actually for the people who think we'd run nothing but outdated games, Traverse, we run nothing but homebrews.
Yeah.
But anyway, a lot of times when I have the laptop open, what's up is not game notes, it's actually game rules or charts or things like that. But what I bring in terms of game notes is generally this. I know coming into the game that there is some difficulty getting people to start role-playing, to feel comfortable, to jump into the action. A lot of times it's hard to get somebody to be first. And so I will come in with a narrated scene or a scene that's very heavy on the NPCs, where the NPCs are really doing a lot of actions and proactively approaching characters and things like that. And it may be very heavily scripted. There may be descriptions that I am all but reading off the paper. And this,
see, I can't do that. And I'm not saying that you're doing it wrong or anything, but if I tried that, to me, that's creating a separation. You know, you're reading the description off the paper. That is creating a separation
between you and your ideas. I'm not saying my way is right. I think the right way to do it is for a game master to do what feels natural to them.
Just feels natural, baby. As
a responsive storyteller. Now, let me stress responsive storyteller. Mm-hmm. If you're just dictating what happens, write a book. Mm-hmm. Don't run a role-playing game.
Box text is the enemy.
Yes. But you know what? Sometimes I come into a role-playing game where that first scene because I know it's going to take me a little bit to get the characters proactive, because they don't know what's going on. They don't know what their options are. They don't know what's occurring in the world. So I've got to set the scene that certain things are occurring. So in detail, I may script out a few NPC interactions, the opening text, but I will try to be familiar enough with it that even though it is scripted, I as a GM can say it in a way where I'm not reading off a piece of paper. It's so well memorized, it's so well rehearsed that I can fall into that NPC's character, recite it and say it without reading off of a piece of paper. You walk like into a room, dubbing. A cold wind blows in. You feel a sense of dread.
No, you feel a sense of rattle, 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 dread.
Yeah.
But in that particular instance, though, you're mixing two examples, which I don't think should be mixed. The example you gave was something that would occur later on in the adventure. And while I agree with you that in general, yeah, for something along those lines, maybe not necessarily box text is the way to go, but for that opening scene, which is a very different animal than a scene later on, to me, that type of descriptive text is necessary. And from my perspective, it's a scene setter, and it's something that creates the mood. And, you know, we've talked about this before, the whole Indiana Jones thing where he's doing something that's only marginally related to the plot in the very opening scene. But yet at the same time, it immerses you in what's going on. But related to that, and I want to jump back to Chad, is as part of your mental week-long prep, I mean, is that something that you, and I've never played under you, but how do you accommodate that type of setting? You know, I mean, how do you make that happen and make that work so that your players are immersed in what's going on?
Let me steal the mic here for a second before we have Chad answer, and I will get Chad a moment to answer here. But I will agree with you, Chris, that the opening scene is very different than the rest of the role-playing game in one major regard, which is that opening scene, unlike everything else in the role-playing game, is 100% GM. The players are looking to you, and you are supposed to tell them where they are and what's going on. Every scene thereafter has something to do with their pushback. The choices they have made during the course of the game, that first opening moment is the only thing that you bring to the table without their immediate input. Now, you may be basing it off their backgrounds or whatever. It's not based on things they've said, which is why I tend to script very heavily the opening scene, whereas everything thereafter is not. Now, I'll come back to what I do with everything thereafter in a second, but I want to give Chad a chance to answer that question. Chad, as a noteless GM, how do you immerse people in that opening scene?
I don't know. I really don't see a difference between the opening scene and any other scene. To me, they're all just scenes. And I suppose that the ideal is to have it catchy, to have hooks in it, and to get players' attention immediately, but...
Well, I think it's more than that. That is part of it. Yeah. But I think in addition to that, you're also passively accepting the fact that they're probably not going to do anything just yet, that they're not going to respond until you give them something to respond to.
I think I kind of want to start poking the players and challenging. That's what I really like doing as a GM. Once I get the story and the flow going, is to really challenge the notions that the players themselves hold, or challenge the notions that the characters hold, and play with that, you know, that sort of, there is no such thing as good and evil. There's shades of gray, and you know, that there is no hard, fast rules, and what you perceive the world to be, how it works socially, is not how it really works socially, and how do you deal with that? And so I kind of like poking the characters, but I think that the first opening scene, to me, that's the thing that you have to get out of the way. That's the first game, first scene, first whatever, the players meet, everybody's uncomfortable, you've been role-playing for 20 years.
I agree, 22 years role-playing, there's nothing I hate more than the first game.
Yeah. It's something
The first scene doesn't have to just be first scene in the first game, though. Every time you come back to the game each week, you've still got to start off with a first scene.
Oh,
it may not be the first scene of the campaign, but
it's
to set the mood. You know how
I do that? Let's throw away the first game, first scene thing, because that's just I don't like it, so I don't really put much into it. I want to get the ball rolling, get the characters onto cool stuff. For how do you get the players going each week?
Yeah.
Is that the week beforehand, I leave them with a cliffhanger. My old group used to hate me for it, and they loved me for it. Well, they didn't love me for it, but they loved the games. Each week, I knew exactly how to end that session. And it was at the moment of maximum, Pat's going to love this one, maximum climax, and then I cut them off. And I'm like, and the dragon rears its head back, and its belly fills with fire, and smoke comes out of its mouth, and the player's like, okay, we're gonna do this, we got this power, what do we gotta do? And then I'm like, and it's 10 o'clock, I'll see y'all next week. And then that is definitely... they are like, God, again, you did it again, Chad! And I'm like, yeah, but you're gonna come back next week pumped, and you're gonna be talking about this all week long.
That is definitely a stylistic difference, because I, you know, as you have seen mm-hmm. probably in the recent games we've run, I don't tend to
you
use...
You want closure and conclusion.
Yeah, it's not conclusion.
Well, yeah.
There's not a cliffhanger, but there's an end to this moment of action, but the fact is the story's still going on. The main bad guy is still out there. The MacGuffin is still out there. We've concluded this episode, and my games are not per se episodic. The dragon rears its head. We've killed the dragon. But the fact is, the evil overlord that owned the dragon is still out there, and he left a taunting note on the dragon's corpse.
Yeah, if my players,
what's next?
If my players
sounds like
screen-
Chad has endings to his sessions like an episode of Lost, and Dan has his endings to episodes of 1970s sitcoms where everybody just kind of freezes right at the end, but they're all in the station and everybody's smiling.
I know the biggest difference here, Cody, is that
two
when Chad
shows,
ends a game,
no one here watches except you.
Yeah, I like Lost still. When Chad ends a game, he doesn't seem to care what we're going to do next, because that's part of what the next game is. Yeah. He wants to get everyone pumped. When Dan ends a game, he's thinking on to the next game, and he wants to be ready for what we want to do. Like a common ending of after Dan's game is, okay, these are the decisions you've got laid out in front of you. What direction do you guys want to go?
Let me put this on a different track, and since Pat hasn't said anything, I'm going to ask this directly.
It's like I get on the podcast, and Pat shuts up.
Yeah.
Yeah, big shock. This has never happened before.
Yeah, really.
I'm going to ask this directly.
You're right, Pat. Kal-El, here's your kryptonite.
Here's my question for you, Pat.
Okay.
I don't want people to think that there are only two styles in the universe.
No,
for one.
Yeah.
I mean, and I don't want them to think that we're saying there's the Chad style and the Dan style.
And one of the reasons I asked Dan the question is because his style is the opposite of yours.
Right.
There's a whole spectrum there that goes all kinds of different directions.
Totally. Well, so, and we're not even the extremes of the examples either.
There are just the extremes in the group.
There are people more improv than Chad, and there are people far more notes heavy than I am.
Yes,
so, yeah, completely. I absolutely agree.
My question for Pat and for everybody, there is a stylistic difference between the GMing, but do you think that there's a stylistic difference between the actual gameplay? When you're playing a game under an improv GM and you're playing a game under a note heavy GM, is there a difference? Can they run the same adventure? And other than the personality of the GMs, would you even be able to tell that there's a stylistic difference?
Honestly, I think that's a very hard question to answer, right? Because how do you really quantify that? Because like what you just said, you've got different personalities of GM. I mean, the best way to answer it would be to say, if I could take you and you run it this week with no notes, and then I could have you run it with notes.
And then we have Wayne do a control.
You know, you know, it's just the difference between you and Dan or you and Wayne.
I can tell you the big difference.
You know what a fascinating way to test that would be is a rotating GM game. Too bad we haven't done one of those recently, Pat.
Okay.
For me, it's very clearly for me that there is a difference. When I'm sitting down to one of Dan's games, every character that comes in, every time someone says something, I'm trying to piece together how that's part of the bigger picture. That's one of the focus, one of the processes going in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
In your games, I'm not trying to put together the different picture. I'm just going along with what happens.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it's a little bit, my thought process is completely different.
I'm also going to say that here's the other problem with it. I've actually only played under you twice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rotating GM, and then the one, you did the one game.
Yeah, and I've only done the rotating GM.
And you didn't do that, so... Honestly, I don't even feel that I can comment a whole lot on the way you do, because I've only had two experiences under it. I mean, if I'd had a few years, it would be different.
Yeah,
and I've had a little bit more under Dan, but you know, so that's, again, that's me. Call me crazy. I'm an engineer. That's the way I
you need,
work.
You're the note-taking GM. You need the hard data.
If I GM, I would definitely be a notes guy, because I didn't have it written down.
Dan, do you think that we kind of do experimental game, like the rotating GM and stuff, ways to get your game out of the box and get people to think of gaming in different ways? Maybe not so much as like the indie community, but we try. Do you think that a GM should try to go outside the box? Like a note heavy GM should try to improv, an improv GM should try taking some damn notes?
Yes and no. I mean, I think certainly a game master, like anyone in any hobby or any profession, ought to always be growing. There are always ways you can improve what you do. And one of the best sources you can pick on for improving what you do is looking what your peers do. You know, I can look at, for example, the way that you, Chad, run your games mm-hmm. and say, okay, what are some things I can take away from that that I can incorporate into what I do?
Theft is art.
Well, for example, being more freeform, letting some of the details slide. But at the same time, you can also reach a point where you're just trying to copy somebody else. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge difference. There's a huge difference between taking inspiration from and plagiarizing. The fact is, I cannot run a Chad game for a very simple reason. I'm not Chad. Hmm. I am not neurologically or psychologically wired like Chad. Hmm. If I was forced to run a Chad-style game, could I do it? Maybe. Could I do it as well as Chad? No. I am wired a certain way, and there's a certain gaming style I excel at, and I ought to be looking for ways to grow my game, to be a better GM, but I cannot escape who it is I am. Mm-hmm. And part of who I am, I know as a game master, the part of the game that I excel at, and doesn't always come out in conventions, but in these long ongoing campaigns, is plot weaving. And the way that I weave those plot, the devil's in the details. There's so much going on and all these little inconsequential things that to you, Chad, you might be making up on the spot and in the gestalt of the game get completely forgotten. Mm-hmm. To me, these are clues leading towards the whole crux of the universe.
Yeah.
And that's why it's different playing under the two is that you're right. Every little thing, I know in your case that that is part of something bigger. In Chad's, it's... That's not necessarily the case. It's just something that happened.
Yeah, I mean, as an example, Wayne, you wrote me, I can't give the details here, so I don't want to spoil too much about the game, but you wrote me an email about our most recent game a couple days ago, saying some things, which I won't repeat, because the other players ought not know. And I had to be very careful in crafting my response, because every word I picked was significant. The exact way things were phrased was going to be significant to the game. Now, does that mean that I'm a better GM than Chad? No. Absolutely not.
And you know, I think it'd be easier for someone like Chad to try your style than the other way around. Because if Chad starts off with the notes and it's not going well,
you can
he can drop notes. It yeah. into his side.
I can't be like, everyone, I'm going to go take a dump for the next 2 hours and write up my notes.
Yeah.
Does anyone have a printer I can take into the bathroom? So, all right, Wayne, getting back to your prior question about how I do the notes. So I will start off, I personally will start off by fairly heavily scripting the intro scene to the game because of the fact that I accept it's the one thing, the one moment of the game where I can expect the players to be reactive instead of proactive because they don't have anything to act upon yet. Right. Thereafter, I tend to keep my notes as high level and plug and play as possible. If there's a detail, if there's something that needs to be named, a date that needs to be remembered, a specific clue I'm going to drop about the plot that needs to be phrased a certain way to give some information, but not too much, I'll script it out. But how it occurs, where it occurs, I may even have it written down, but I'm not paying attention to it.
What percentage of your notes actually get used on an average game?
I would say probably about 75%. And I would say of the remaining 25%, maybe half don't get used at all. Maybe half get used, but not the way I intended.
That's an interesting ratio because of the scenes that I paint in my head, the events, the things that happen, 99.99% of them get used. If I recycle something, it's something that has been done.
You know, there's advantages and disadvantages to every playstyle. Of course, the biggest advantage being the game master's comfortable with it.
Yeah.
But maybe part of the unspoken advantage here is that in improv style, anything goes anywhere.
Yeah.
In well, a written
that's exactly
style.
It. I can, if you write a note, a scene on paper, it's there, it's solid. And if something happens in the game where it's a round peg trying to fit in a square hole and the players made that hole square, well, you know, you're just not going to use it. And maybe you'll use it later. Maybe you just will throw it out. With me, I just reshape it. I just the players have turned a square hole into a round hole, and I've just turned my square block into a round block, and now it works.
I guess I don't see how that can't be done with the written word, though, as well. I mean,
yeah.
You know, you can take your notes, you can jot down ideas, you know, sure. one sentence thing, which would be the equivalent of what you have floating around in your head. I think that you could do that, too. I think that probably the percentage use is just, it's a difference in the, in the GM.
Very well.
You're correct, Pat. In fact, that is what I strive for is beyond that initial scene. I try to make as much of the plot and dialogue as I can plug and play for that reason. It may be scripted because I know the limits of my memory and I know the type of game I want to run. But the fact is, I'm taking these notes in the first place because of the fact that my mind ticks differently than Chad's. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if I had the same desire, capacity, whatever you want to call it, that Chad did to create a purely improv game, I wouldn't even be taking notes. The fact that I'm taking notes says from the outset that either because of my game style, I'm incapable of remembering that kind of stuff, or to make this sound less deficient, the type of game I'm running has a certain level of detail that cannot be done by an improv GM. Because, once again, unless you have this eidetic perfect memory, you just can't remember that many details.
Well, on the same lines, I said I'd be pulled out of immersion if Chad was going along and he forgot the name or threw a different name. Along the same lines, in one of your games, if you were coming along and you had to stop and, you know, just sit there for a minute, I think that would have the same consequence. So, I mean, notes right there for, you know, your type of mind that isn't necessarily Chad's kind of game. I think they would have to be essential.
And on the length and percentage thing, too, remember that if Dan doesn't write enough, he needs to go back and write more, whereas I just keep improvising it out. And if Dan writes too much, it's too much. And there's a cut made and 20% doesn't get used. Whereas if I have too much in my mind, I just keep going with it. It's hard to say.
Going back to those percentages, Dan, I think it says a lot about the style that you have that you still have such a high percentage of notes that aren't used. Because that shows that from the note-taking perspective and having all that information is not necessarily a bad thing, and that players still really kind of are driving. And you're facilitating it as you should be, as opposed to, you know, like we said before, writing a book. That says a lot about that particular style, that it's really heavy-handed or tightly controlled.
I 200% agree.
And all the math majors suddenly winced when you said
that. I know,
that.
But that's fine. I don't care. It's still true. I 200% agree. That
Pat's shaking his head. He's like,
well, I don't care. Pat can shake his head all he wants. As an engineer, I've asked him for about 6 weeks now to give me a piece of information, which is what is the recoil on a rail gun.
I'm going
to
look that up.
Point being, I agree with you, Chris, that notes are not a script. If notes have become a script consistently, and I accept a room description, a bit of dialogue, maybe a script, that's fine. But if the notes as a whole are a script, something has failed here in the game mastering process, because you are now dictating a story, not creating an interactive world. And one of the questions we get every so often is, how do you take those bits of scripted notes, the room description, the dialogue, and not make it sound like script? And I don't have any advice for you except for know your material so well you can get it out without sounding like a script. One of the things that I've done is if I know they're going to contact some guy and this guy needs to tell them three bits of plot, but I don't want to be reading off a piece of paper. You look at the king. He winces nervously. He pulls out a scroll that is larger than any scroll you have seen before.
Ladies in waiting blush.
Yeah.
He's the king, baby.
I don't do that. What I'll do is I'll bullet point three things. In the course of this conversation, the king needs to tell you the dragon's located over here. This is the only way to kill the dragon. And this is how you get to the only way to kill the dragon. I will make up on the spot the speech by which he says that. And the other thing that does that gives me the ability to react to the players. If the players cut him off or take him in a weird direction mid-speech, then I can follow that. All I know is there's a couple points I need to cover. I don't have a speech I need to dictate where if a player says something, I have to hush them and be like, no, the king is talking. Quiet you.
Your dialogue is not in my box text.
Press X to continue. That's all you're allowed to do right now. Yeah. And get back to that. You know, but I have bullet points of these are the things that need to get covered or come out at some point. And of course, if they shut up or walk off to where the king can't finish, well, what I'll do is I'll take a pen and I'll circle the little bullet next to those points. Like, okay, they need to hear this somewhere. And in my head, is there role play, and I'll be trying to come up with, man, who else in the town would know this? Well, maybe the sage would know it. So when they go down the street,
a problem where it's not just, oh, they go to the sage and that's that, where they go to the sage, we kill the sage, and then you're like, okay, well, maybe the barkeep, and they go to the barkeep and like, we set the barkeep on fire, or we just don't listen, you know, it doesn't have to be violent. And they go from point to point to point, you're like, damn it, guys, stop doing this crazy crap.
Yes, but when it's gone that far,
you usually tell Chad to give you a moment.
No, when it's gone that far, I presume that actually something else has gone wrong, which is either the players have failed to develop their character motivations or I have failed to understand them. Because if I cannot get the information out to them, either I don't understand who they're going to listen to, or they've not told me who they'll listen to.
Wouldn't the best way to make it natural be kind of combine a little what Chad does and actually approach it as, you know, you're the GM, this is your NPC, actually roleplay the NPC out. Have the conversation as if this were your character in front of you that you're playing, and you would know what you'd be wanting to say. You would know your bullet points, but instead of trying to give a speech or instead of trying to just pass the information along, actually try to get into the character of, this is how I feel the character would play it, as if you were playing the game instead of GMing.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that's what I do. I mean, I put bullet points, sometimes not even what the character will say, but simply what the character knows and what he intends to say. And what the players do may get more or less than. In fact, sometimes I'll even put contingencies in there. If they're nice to this guy, or if they say a certain thing, he may also tell them XYZ. If they're a jerk to him, this point may not get conveyed. And I kind of write these little contingencies. They're very loose. I mean, you cannot make a decision tree. You cannot make this.
Oh, you can. Well, but you do if you want to find out exactly what your players will not do, guaranteed.
Yeah, precisely.
Totally against it.
This is not a video game. There are not three options to pick from. There's a lot of options to pick from, and you won't think of them all. And so I don't create a decision tree, but I do try to create these contingencies within the plot. I mean, once again, I don't think the GMing style is 100% notes or 100% improv. I think every GM out there is some percentage notes and some percentage improv. The question is not whether you're 100-0. The question is what that balance is. And I think whereas Chad is probably 95% improv and 5% notes.
Because I do scratch names on paper. And stuff.
Honestly, I think you're more notes than you give credit for, because the notes are just in your head. Yeah. They're not written down, but I know that you ahead of time have actually made essentially what Dan would have written down or what I would have written down. Mm-hmm. I know, because I've seen you do it, that going through your head.
And I'll put that out in all fairness. I mean, all the jokes I make about eidetic memory aside, mm-hmm. I mean, the fact is, if you can remember those details and keep them straight, more power to you. I struggle with that. I need notes in front of me simply because of deficiencies of memory. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it may just come down to who you are. But let's talk about something else here related to that, which is the notes you take during the game. Because you as a game master have a power that comes with a consequence. The power we've trumpeted many times in the past, which is
that women throw themselves at the game master.
I tell you, I have never had so many panties tossed at me on the street until I was game master.
Yeah,
it's a weird thing that I do.
As the game progresses, you as a game master have the power that until you declare something, it's not fact. If you have in your notes that certain things occur in town A and they go to town B, you can move it over to town B. We talk about this all the time. The flip side to this coin is that once you stated it, now it is persistent truth of the world. When you said the bartender's name is Phil, it is now Phil. It is not anything but Phil. When you stated the bartender has a dysfunctional relationship with his wife, that is now a persistent fact of the world. And so as a game master, it may behoove you, depending on the game you're running. Now, of course, you can BS this, because if they come in the next time, maybe Phil's not working that shift. Or maybe he's having an unusually positive day regarding his wife. I don't know.
Even better, if he says the wrong name, that's now part of the plot.
Yeah, or whatever. But the point being that it oftentimes behooves you to take notes of your own on the fly. And this may be true of players. This may be true of the game master. In our current game, for example, when Pat contacted a friend of his for the first time, I realized, much to my chagrin, that we had never named his contact until the first time we contacted him. And all of a sudden, okay, it's Lieutenant Colonel Soyuz. And so I had to write that down on a piece of paper.
As did I.
Well, now, the great thing is that has now guaranteed a certain amount of persistence and permanency to what I've written down. But the downside is, particularly once you get past the first game to the second game, the third game, the 10th game, the 20th game, these little errant notes have no organization. It's just a thousand little jots in the margins of notes or on various pieces of paper. You as a game master need a system, if you're going to do this, for keeping that stuff straight.
You know, not just as a game master. I remember my first game was a Skies of Glass game. I went in, and if you remember, I had notebook paper. I'm taking notes the entire time. And after the first couple weeks, suddenly I have all these notes all over the place that completely random thoughts throughout the course of the game. No organization. I have no clue where any of them fit in. And 98% of them were completely irrelevant because I had no idea what to take notes on.
What I did to combat that problem, because I definitely ran into that, was I had a separate journal that was dedicated solely to the campaign that I was running. And each session, I dated it and marked off the characters that were present. And then in the space that was left, I kept, you know, essentially liner notes as to people they encountered, you know, brief personality points or whatnot. And so it became easy as the game went on. You could get a kind of mental reference as to, oh, this was the guy back in this town. Okay. And I remember that being, okay, that was about four or five sessions ago. So you could just flip back and look. And because what you do say is a real problem. Without some way to organize those notes, you may as well just not even take them because that's not going to matter, you know, half a dozen sessions down the road. But for me, that was a system that worked out pretty well. And just kind of keeping it all organized so that it was very easy to find. And yeah, sometimes my memory failed me and I wasn't able to remember exactly enough, but it was enough to at least fake it to get you by to the point where it was still real enough for the players.
You know, while Colin's idea might help it to organize, I prefer laptops because then you just have either the big file or, in my case, I love OneNote because I
hate laptops
a different
game.
I have with a laptop, I have OneNote and I've got different tabs for each game. But you can just hit Control F and search.
Right.
So if you're weeks down the line, you don't have to worry about having, I mean, organization definitely will help you, but you can do a quick search when something comes up.
Let me throw out two things here that may help you as well, which is, first off, one of the things that I think is underappreciating gaming in general, and once again, we've talked about one angle, so let's talk about the other, is what happens after the game. Now, we've talked many times on the show about the post-game conversation where the game master talks to the players about where things are headed, what they think of the game, so on and so forth. But the game master also, in addition to preparing their notes prior to the game each week, also it might work in their best interest to consolidate their notes after game each week to say, okay, I'm going to keep a running Excel spreadsheet of NPCs they've encountered that I can search later or whatever. Whatever things I jotted down, I'm going to incorporate these back into some kind of notes that I can keep track of. Now, something that works great for this that's free now is creating a wiki. This is something I've played under several game masters that have done. I've never personally done it yet. I may eventually. But for campaigns, I've played under many game masters, including one right now. I'm playing an online game using map tools with John as the game master, but he is using wiki spaces, and I'll try to link this off the show notes.
He even linked it in a thread. I was looking through those the other day.
Okay, I wasn't going to disclose the link if he hadn't already done so publicly, but I'll try to link at least the wiki spaces side off the show notes, where you can keep a generalized wiki. And the great thing about a wiki is the fact that they're internally hyperlinked. If they discover some stuff, you spend a couple hours as a game master, and I know this sucks, particularly given you're probably already busy life, but guess what? This is just a game master's cross to bear, is you go in after the game, spend an hour or two or three updating the wiki with the things that occurred or the factoids that came out during the prior game, and they're there and nice and easy to find, and particularly if you're playing with a laptop as an internet connection. Chad, I know you're not a big fan of laptop for the same reason you're not a big fan of the DM screen. But the fact is, if you need to look something up, you know, you push it off to the side, keep it there.
Well, I'm
flip
not
through a few links, and
I'm not a fan of the laptop more because laptops tend to have internet connections, and I think that
that's
just
why I intentionally
way when I, too distracting.
That's why when I use them, I don't have the internet enabled. I could easily ask, you know, the guy whose house we're at for wireless. And I intentionally choose not to just because I don't want to even have the temptation.
I do, but I'm not tempted by it. It just, I don't know, the way I'm wired or whatever just doesn't tempt me.
So, Dan, if you used a wiki, how would you deal if something came out and the players, let's say players believed A, but reality is B? intentionally let them go down the wrong path.
This goes back to the kind of notes I keep. Now, I started off by saying that I script the first scene. Everything thereafter is kind of plug and play factoids and plot points. But there's a third document. It's a fourth document. The third document being the list of NPCs. There's a fourth document I keep that I don't talk about real often on the show, which generally I title the document, What's Really Going On, dot, dot. And what that lays out is, okay, this happened. This guy did this. Here's a year's worth of history prior to the game. And all the convoluted facts and all the factions that are involved in this and all the lies being told, this is what's really going on. And what that does is, particularly in a game that's so plot heavy versus character heavy or feel heavy or setting heavy, I need that as a way for me to keep straight the clues that I'm dropping.
I can't believe you're going to leave a file that's such a big concept out when I'm asking the question about your notes. That sounds like a huge piece of the
it is, and I don't know, truth be told, why I don't bring it up more often. I probably should, truth be told, but yeah, for my style of gaming that's plot heavy and note heavy, yes, absolutely. I one of the first things I write, in fact, sometimes this is the first document I create in a campaign, is what's really going on. The real plot is this: these factions are doing this, here's the maneuvering, here's the lies, here's the whatever. And what I'll then do is say, okay, how do the players fit into this? And I can get some of that based on the characters they've given me. Some of that I just have to figure out as the game goes on, because I don't know what they're going to do. And, you know, one thing I want to throw out, even as a notes-heavy GM, the notes are not a chain. They are a guide. I love nothing more about game mastering than being surprised. There was a situation that came up in the game we ran this past Sunday.
You mean the worst plan ever?
No, it was not the worst plan ever. Where they...
I did not want to do this plan.
They were supposed to be basically the victims of a bad guy who was then going to gain a lot of power and go out into the galaxy, this is a science fiction game, and do a lot of very bad things. And they were going to spend the next several games, weeks, months, years, trying to clean up the mess they had allowed to occur. And instead... they did a plan, and I'm a firm believer, and if they roll it, they get it. They pulled off a plan I did not expect, used very resourcefully what they had working for them to get away with the MacGuffin. And the bad guy doesn't have it anymore, and he's now looking for them.
I mean, it was perfect. It was a Hail Mary. I mean, it was essence of Hail
and
Mary.
And it worked. It worked. The
it
dice,
was the most improbable. It was a 120-yard touchdown pass.
The dice on the bad guy's side kept coming up massively low. The good guy's side kept outrolling them. The ideas they came up with, I had not expected.
I came up with a dozen plans. Basically, we had two guys who had guns to their head and two guys who were off somewhere else. It would be sort of a long story to tell it, but I went through at least a dozen different plans, and I voiced some of them, and they kept getting shot down for this reason and this reason and this reason. And then I had the plan that we went with, but we hadn't gone with it yet, and I was like, oh my God, this plan is horrible and it won't work. And then I pulled out another plan and that wouldn't work. Pulled out another plan. I'm like, okay, the Hail Mary. God, I don't want to do this. Someone's going to get killed.
And it worked.
And it worked.
It worked. Well, and I did not throw you a bone as a GM. Mm-hmm. I just played it fairly. This is what it's going to take. Let's do it. And to give you guys a little bit of background.
Okay, should we tell them the plan?
Well, let's give a little bit of background here. I don't want to go into a gaming story too much, but a little bit of background was these.
There's so many people right now. Just tell that damn story.
We're playing a science fiction game where they're playing guys that run a salvage ship. Okay, they go into systems, they find a wrecked or abandoned ship that there's no claim on, and they basically cut it apart, take it back, and salt the pieces. Well, their ship ended up getting infected with what to them appears to be, I won't say what really is because the plot's still ongoing, but appears to be.
The clue. Appears to be.
Appears to be some kind of a virus, or like an artificial intelligence kind of taking over part of the ship. And it basically steered them to a particular other ship where they were supposed to unlock a device that contains the MacGuffin, okay, which this thing wants. When they got out there, this thing had every advantage on them. Bigger guns, better armor, this was
another ship.
There's another ship involved, and everything was all military grade, whereas they're more of civilians. But the one thing they had going was being a salvage operation. They may not have had military grade. They had industrial grade. And so here's these military grade robots meant to fight things that are from the military. And they send these great big freight train type robots into their way.
Well, here's the thing it wasn't like, oh, here come the bad guys. Let's send the big robots after them. No, here's a hostage situation. And instead of sending in the SWAT team, we're sending in three bulldozers.
Yeah, and it worked. I mean, we rolled out the dice. I'm a big believer in Game Master fairness. It worked. And so I gave it to him. I fully expected the plot to end a very different way, and that's not how it ended. But what I was going to talk about is the other angle, which I don't think needs as much discussion, but is worthy of mention, is player notes. Mm-hmm. Not the notes the Game Master keeps, but the notes the player keeps. The players, and at least I've seen in my games, will oftentimes keep notes on plot, sometimes area maps, not as much. I don't run a lot of heavy, like, 5-foot by 5-foot gridded dungeon crawls. But, you know, if you do, great.
Thank God.
NPC interactions or NPC names. You as a player, if you keep those, let me give you a few potential things to look for. One is just like a game master, there is a good balance between too much and too little. Now, the disadvantage is as a player, you don't know what's significant. The game master does. Mm-hmm. So you as a player may be tempted to take more notes than you need to because you don't realize that something you've heard is a major clue to the plot versus just the ravings of a crazy old lady. Mm-hmm. But I tell you, I love it when my players take notes for two reasons. One, it shows me they're interested. I know I've got my players hooked when they are writing, reviewing, and discussing notes on the things I've said. Mm-hmm. The second thing, it keeps me honest. Because if they know what this guy was called and they know what he said, I damn well better know twice as well what his name was and what he said and why he said it, because they are going to bring it back up. And so it is both daunting and exhilarating when my players take notes.
Yeah, I think that players definitely should take notes. And I'm not saying that I necessarily do this. I'm bad in the fact that I don't take a lot of notes. But my advice is that as a respectful player to your GM, you should take notes about what's going on. It is a courtesy that you're extending to the GM to write down that NPC name or that person's name. And then whenever you interact with them, you've got that name, as opposed to sitting there going, oh, yeah, I'm going to go talk to that bartender. I forget what his name is, but, you know, you remember the name. It's the sort of immersion. But I think it's just being a good player. Now, like I said, that being said, I don't always do that, but I do try. Like the case you mentioned with me, when we came up with that name for my contact, Soyuz, I wrote it down. I even asked you, how do you spell it? Is it spelled like the space probe? I'm like, yep, it is. So I wrote it down on my character sheet. So I've got that. So
I finally realized why I quit taking notes. I took notes heavily when I first started and I was trying to put together the whole plot and all, and I never really used them. I think that was why I quit. They didn't come in handy.
I think that the notes, like player notes, it's like taking a 100 level class in college. You take notes for it, even though you don't need to. It's not so that you can go back and refer to and study your notes. It's that when you write something down, you tend to remember it.
That's true. But it is good for referral backwards. But the other good point there is you've got to find that happy medium of too much, too little. I played with a person that took way too many notes. I mean, she was taking notes on the individual rounds of combat. Mm. And what was really bad about that would be is when it would get to be her turn, she'd
that's
be like, well,
notes.
Hold on,
that's
wait
a disorder.
Well, yeah. So she'd be writing down what happened instead of actually doing something. And that was, that was bad. So that's the extreme.
Well,
case.
Something else I think a player ought to have notes on is their character. This is something I did not do in our current campaign that I wish I had, and it almost killed the campaign because I didn't. But after this last game, I feel pretty good about things.
Well, that, and you also have a wall of text email from me with all of my character background.
Oh, I know. But is one of the things that I typically require of people is they give me at least one paragraph of personality, at least one paragraph of background, and two or three unresolved hooks from their background. And one of the things that I recommend players do is not just have notes on the ongoing plot, but just as the game master comes with plot notes, they ought to come with that one page printout on their character. Review it, remember it. It gives you kind of, as we talked about last episode, that moment of zen to get back into character, to remember who he is, the issues he's struggling with, the questions that have not been resolved in his past, and to play that in the game. And so I think a player ought to come with some degree of notes, just as the Game Master does, not just on the plot, but on the one major thing they're contributing to the game, which is their player character.
Yeah, I think you're right. Again, I think it's good for players to do that. But again, I'm very bad in the fact that I actually haven't done that in a long time with characters. I've done it with certainly with a handful, but it seems like recently my character background has been sort of a Chad kind of a thing. I sort of have it up here, so a little bit more nebulous in my head. Yeah. I don't write it down on paper because I don't see the value of it. And I understand where you're coming from, Dan. It's like you want something to work with, but
in this game in previous ones, I haven't seen that be a problem for you, but I have seen that be a problem where it kind of hurts my immersion when I'm sitting there playing and someone else at the table, their character is one way one week and another entirely different way the next week.
Right.
And it's not the same character. It's a, this was the mood I came in with today versus the
and
last
like
week.
For me, I think I've been able to sort of flesh out as we play a few sessions and that's where it comes. And, you know, like exactly take the little notes here and there. So I look at it more as, I used to do it that way. Like I said, back in the beginning, I was more, here's my background. This is what happened to my family. This is why, my parents are dead. The typical Bruce Wayne-ish type of thing. And I think I just got sort of bored with that. I was thinking, you know what? Why do I have to play this terribly tragic guy that has all this crap that happened to him in the past? Mm-hmm. Why can't I just be more of a normal, everyday kind of a person, sort of?
That's a point that hasn't been brought up to this point, which is the exercise of writing something down, both for the game master and the player, does sometimes reinforce your ruts. You start to notice your ruts more when you're writing it as opposed to when you're just saying it. Because sometimes by the time you're saying it, it's too late. But if you have to write it every week, you're like, holy crap, how many characters am I going to write whose parents are dead? I mean, do I really need another one? Look at the clock. We're pretty much hitting up against time. So I want to remind you guys once again, get your questions in to Chris@FearTheBoot.com regarding health and wellness issues.
I will do my best.
Yes. And in two episodes, we will come back and try to answer those. And in the meantime, get out to fearthecon.com, get signed up, get your events in there. I will tell you guys,
FYI, the last slot is looking a little light. I am calling on all of our GM friends. If we can throw a couple of games in the final slot, slot 6, you'd be really helping us out.
Well, and also I will say that I intend to run one more, probably Apocryphos, maybe Transformers, but probably Apocryphos game. And I'm waiting to set it up until a little bit closer to the con, because I want to give people who don't stay on the bleeding edge of what we do a chance to participate. So keep watching those feeds, get signed up for events, create your own events, and we look forward to seeing you then. In the meantime, take care, and we will catch you next time.
It's good to have you back, Cadwallader.
Yeah. Hey. So nice to hear from you, Calvin.
Thanks, you four guys.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2010. Listeners are free to use the show in a non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to FearTheBoot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at FearTheBoot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at PulpGamer.com.